From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
And good morning. This is Ken Rogge on WDEO and filling in for Bob Gould for just a few minutes because he is at Selfridge Air National Guard Base, and we're going to be going to him in just a few minutes. But first, we got a couple of news items we want to pass on to you. An indignant federal appeals court has ordered the government to keep paying benefits to hundreds of Vietnam veterans afflicted with a type of leukemia that has been linked to the defoliant Agent Orange. The Department of Veterans Affairs has argued that it owed payments only from October 2003 forward rather than from when a claim was filed. U.S. District Judge Felton Henderson disagreed in 2005 and ordered retroactive benefits instead, which the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco upheld last week while saying it hoped that obstructionist bureaucratic opposition will now cease. Legislation offered by U.S. Senators Larry Craig and Daniel Acha to provide better treatment for those with traumatic brain injuries was unanimously adopted recently on the floor of the U.S. Senate and is now part of the National Defense Authorization Act, currently being debated in the Senate. Under the amendment, VA officials would be able to place veterans with brain injuries into medical facilities outside the VA hospital system. It also requires that an initial mental health evaluation be provided to veterans or returning service members no later than 30 days following a request for such an evaluation. The website of the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Reserve Affairs has some new resources for reserve component families. Visitors to the website can download a commander's toolkit and a family toolkit, which provides reserve families with information on how to plan for deployment, financial management, legal affairs, and reintegration. Also, the website has new and updated versions of Guard and Reserve Benefits Guide and the Education and Retirement Guides. The website is defenselink.mil/RA. That's defenselink.mil/RA. On Saturday, July 21st, 2007, 150 people gathered near the flagpole at the Portsmouth, Rhode Island High School baseball field to dedicate the Sisson Memorial. Sergeant Donald Henry Sisson was a member of the first graduating class of Portsmouth High School in 1966 and was killed in action in Vietnam on February 23rd, 1969. Organized by Christine Hayward, Vice Commander of American Legion Post 18, the event included a tattered flag collection station manned by local Girl Scouts, who also helped distribute programs to attendees. 40 3x5-foot American flags were given away. And welcome home. Each week on Veterans Radio, we welcome home servicemen and women who have been stationed around the world in the service of our country. 130 soldiers from the Headquarters Company, 38th Division Support Command, Kokomo, Indiana, received a welcome home celebration. And 95 soldiers from the Minnesota National Guard were welcomed home by the Anoka, Minnesota community on Friday, July 27th. Thousands of Thief River Falls, Minnesota residents gathered on Friday, July 27th, to welcome home 39 soldiers from Company B, 136th Infantry. A welcome home tribute was held to honor the 1st 188th ADA Sec 4 on July 28th in North Dakota. A special remembrance was held in honor of four soldiers who paid the ultimate price in Iraq. A welcome home party was held on Friday, July 27th in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, to greet 25 soldiers from the 2nd Combined Arms Battalion with the 136th Infantry. Soldiers from the Nevada Army National Guard's 1st Squadron, 221st Cavalry Regiment, returned to Las Vegas, Nevada on Saturday, July 28th. And 60 soldiers of the 174th Headquarters Battalion were welcomed by friends and family on Friday, July 27th in Woodlawn, Ohio. Welcome Home is sponsored by the Marine Scholars Fund, a program of Ave Maria University. Visit them online at Ave Maria University. .edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. Welcome home.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University by combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call Aaron Flaherty, Assistant Director of Admissions, at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
How many of you are suffering from some kind of chronic pain? If you are, then you're just one of millions of people our age who just live with it. I strongly suggest that you give Quantum Physical Therapy a call at 734-483-9200. Quantum Physical Therapy is a multifaceted facility providing cutting-edge conventional and alternative rehabilitation services. The highly qualified and friendly staff at Quantum are the movement experts and are committed to coming up with a specific solution for your specific problem. Whether it's pain, weakness, swelling, nerve injury, amputation, disease, or age-related morbidity, they can help you lead a productive life. Quantum Physical Therapy has two locations, one at 5417 Whitaker Road in Ypsilanti, and the other at 6180 Michigan Avenue in Saline. That's Quantum Physical Therapy, 734-483-9200, or on the web at www.qptherapy.com.
Well, here we are from Selfridge Air National Guard Base right here in Mount Clemens, Michigan, and I am broadcasting a first for Veterans Radio. We're broadcasting inside an airplane. That's right. We're inside a P-3. Are you ready for this, guys? Orion. I know. Lake Orion, for all you folks that aren't from Michigan, Lake Orion is a nearby town, and all week I've had a mental thing with I believe they're even spelled the same, aren't they? So maybe it should be Lake Orion, Well, anyway, if I do happen to say Orion, I promise every time I do to put $20 into the flower fund at the VA. How about that, And I'm with, right now, five members of the Patrol Squadron 93 Association. They'll be on deck here in just a moment. But once again, I want to welcome all of you to our show. And while we are live, we're doing another one of our remotes. Last week we were at the Dayton Air Show, and this week we're here at the Selfridge Air National Guard Base. And that's an interesting thing about Orion, Orion being the hunter, and that's what our subject is today, sub-hunters. These are the guys that went out for long hours at a time looking for that silent enemy, silent but deep. That was our patrols there out there looking for those submarines. Now, my first guest right now is Randy Houghton. Randy Houghton was a patrol plane commander. His responsibility, his duty, was the safety of the aircraft. Right now, well, tell you what, Randy, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what are you doing now and how did you get involved with the 93 Patrol Squadron?
Thank you, Bob. I joined the Navy back at Gros Eel in 1965, pursuit of a lifelong dream of being a Navy pilot, and got my first choice out of flight training, the P-3 Orion, and I got to fly it all over the world. We were flying patrols off of Vietnam. We were flying patrols against the Soviets in the Mediterranean. We were flying against Soviet submarines out of Bermuda and Keflavik up in Iceland. And Then I was going to stay in the Navy, and they put me on an aircraft carrier, and I was flying the mail plane off the aircraft carrier, and then they said, well, we got too many pilots, so you'll have to do something else if you want to stay in the Navy. So I got out because I heard there was a patrol squadron up here at Detroit, VP-93 being formed up, and I joined VP-93, and I flew with them for 8 years. And then they told me I was too good-looking, I couldn't fly anymore. And
promoted, how about that, guys?
And they promoted me to Navy captain, and I retired in 1991. I fly for USA Jet Airlines now on the outside.
What first started my interest in this particular subject matter, I was talking with Randy about 2 months ago, and he mentioned that this was the number two budgeted item during World War II. Of course, number one being the Manhattan Project. Strike that. Why don't you go ahead and explain that, Randy?
The second most expensive project in World War II was anti-submarine warfare and the development of microwave radar that allowed the patrol airplanes to use their radar and find the submarines on the surface. So the most expensive was the B-29, which was a Manhattan Project delivery weapon.
Oh, okay. So that was part of the Manhattan Project, the B-29. That was all lumped in then, right?
Correct.
I understand that was like billions of dollars in today's dollars.
It'd be the equivalent of buying 5,000 B-2 bombers.
Okay, well, but how about your program? Now, did it initially start with what? B-25s? What were they using?
During World War II, the primary anti-submarine warfare airplane was the Navy version of the B-24 bomber because it had extremely long range. They could put extra gas in the bomb bays and keep the airplane in the air up almost to 20 hours, and it could cover the entire Atlantic Ocean. And during the latter part of the war, there was radar coverage in the ocean at all times. It really forced the German submarines to stay down, and they could not charge their batteries, which limited their operations.
And so what was the result of that?
Well, in 1942, the Germans were sinking ships off the U.S. coast in the Atlantic at a rate they couldn't even be built at. And after May of 1943, when this microwave radar was put on these airplanes, the German submarine fleet only sank another 23 ships in the last almost 2.5 years of the war.
And if I'm not mistaken, I believe only 25% of all the sailors that sailed in the German submarine fleet survived the war.
That is correct. That was a very dangerous job to be a German submarine.
So you guys, your counterparts way back in World War II were very successful.
That is correct.
Back after that time, in the late 50s, the Soviet Union had about 400 submarines. That's quite a bit compared to what the Germans had, so it was a continued threat. The United States needed an airplane. What happened?
With the growth of the submarine fleet in the Soviet Union and the Soviets' pretty much blatant aggression throughout the world, the U.S. was caught unprepared in 1949 by the Korean War, and they vowed never to do it again. So they identified they needed an airplane that could go anywhere in the world, get there fast, stay a long time, and be able to counter this Soviet submarine threat. And the Lockheed Electra was picked as the model prototype to build the P-3 Orion. And they did it because it was a fast airplane. It's over 400 miles an hour. It'll stay in the air 20 hours. It can operate out of almost any airport in the world, unprepared, without support. A very, very versatile airplane.
Is it still in operation?
Yes, the airplane, they built about 500 of these, and there's about 100 of them still flying operational missions around the world.
So they're still operational in their mission.
That is correct. Not so much anti-submarine warfare anymore. They've developed a new technique of surveillance, and it's highly classified.
Well, as I said, folks, this is a first for Veterans Radio. We are right inside the fuselage with, I believe, Navy guys, right? We have no Air Force guys. Of course not. Navy. This is a Navy mission. And looking around me, I'm in the, the ordnance section here, perhaps? That looks like some areas of store, some buoys, maybe? And what else do we have here?
Well, you're sitting at the Sonoboy station, and that was our primary weapon to search for submarines. And we would kick these sonobuoys out of the airplane from altitude, and they would drop into the water, and then they'd radio back what they heard. And then one of our sensor operators would analyze this noise to see if there was any submarines hiding in the water.
And, of course, you were very adapt at finding what you needed to find, right? How deep could these submarines go deeper to where they can't be heard? Or, you know, Red October, right? They had a propeller that was supposedly to be silent, or a propulsion system.
You're really addressing something that's outside my area. I was responsible for safety of flight, that the engines keep burning and we didn't run out of gas and stuff. The technique of finding a submarine belonged to the guys in the back of the airplane, and they knew all about that. And in fact, I have one sitting right next to me here, Jerry.
That sounds like, I think, a segue, Jerry. Yeah, we get the equipment. How are you doing? This is Jerry Locke, and Jerry Locke is with us. He was the acoustics man, the sensor operator. How many of these things would you drop in the ocean?
In one mission. In one mission? I've been at long missions where we've thrown out 60, 65 sonobuoys. We've had sonobuoys stowed all over the airplane.
Did you have to recover them after?
That's question is always asked. No, there's places in the world.
Well, who collected the deposit?
There's places in the world you could probably.
Well, here in Michigan, we have a bottle deposit. They have a sensor deposit.
No, there's places in the world where you could actually walk across the bottom on sonobuoys, like around the streets of Gibraltar. We've thrown out hundreds of sonobuoys.
How long would they emit their signal?
Well, we basically would code it so that it would either be 1, 3, or 8 hours. Some of them are longer, but we would actually set the sonoboy to stay up a certain number of times.
Okay, I see here is a parachute. How did you launch these? I'm sure you didn't throw them out the side door here.
No, this package that you've got all the equipment on right now is a series of holes, and pneumatically they would be shut out the bottom of the airplane.
And depth of how deep could they go?
Well, anywhere from 80 feet down to 1,500 feet of cable are in each one of these sonobuoys.
1,500 feet. Where was the cable stored?
Right inside.
Right in the cylinder.
Yeah, yeah. And if you ever struggle with a 100-foot extension cord, you understand the problem of making sure 1,500 feet of cable go out. We've had very few failures, very few. They're marvelous pieces of equipment.
Well, what is the length of this?
Oh, it's
about 3 feet?
3.5 feet.
Three and a half feet mm-hmm. and maybe 5 inches across?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you stored 1,500 feet of cable in there.
And not only that, but it has a flotation device, an antenna, a transmitter, as well as a device to lower a hydrophone, which is an underwater microphone, at the bottom of this cable.
And there you were. You put these at different depths.
Yep.
You had a grid, right? That you.
Yeah. The TACO, which we'll be hearing about a little later, would actually develop a pattern with the acoustic operator, put a series of sonobuoys in the water, and they would listen to all the noises in the water.
Oh, I bet there's a.
And it's a very noisy place, very noisy environment. You have a lot of whales, shrimp. You wouldn't believe the amount of noise.
Shrimp make noise?
Oh, incredibly, incredibly. A lot of surface shipping.
What do they say? Don't eat me.
A lot of chatter.
I go good with cocktail sauce. I can't believe shrimp make noise.
Very, very noisy. Yeah, very noisy. And there might be a submarine there that doesn't want to be heard. And so all of those noises gets transmitted up to the airplane, and my job would be to use the technology of the dive fire equipment, the acoustic equipment, as well as the art form of actually trying to figure out what that noise is. Is it a surface ship? Is it a submarine? If it is a submarine, what nationality the submarine is?
And you could tell.
And if it's a Soviet submarine, what class of submarine it is? We'd be responsible to actually detect or determine each frequency or each noise that was being put out.
Folks, if you remember the movie Red October,
yep.
Jonesy,
yep. The sonar man.
He was the sonar man. The same operation that Jerry here did. So just to kind of give you a little bit of a orientation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You're listening to whales. I had to ask this. I asked this to Randy on the way up here. Is it the album, the top 10 whale songs, or? And I'm curious, how did anybody get down there to record whale songs, right? And then Randy, of course, being the Navy man that he is, said, well, we recorded them and then played them back, and then you, Jerry, must have listened to them time and time again to get yourself proficient.
Yeah. Just remember, everything that actually the sonoboys picked up, we actually recorded during each mission on an analog tape recorder, and they were played back. It was played back after we'd landed, after a 10, 14-hour flight. we ended up having to go through 2 to 3 hours of debrief where they would spin that tape through a computer and even maybe pick out more signatures that maybe we didn't see in the airplane. And we were graded on it. Everybody was graded on every flight, every crew position on the success of the mission.
Okay, so once again, you're in the airplane. Mm-hmm. You're flying a grid. You, first of all, drop the Sonoboys.
Mm-hmm.
Am I saying that right? Sonoboys. There we go. Sonoboys. You drop those. And then you go back into the grid and start listening.
Yeah, we could listen up to 16 to 32 sonoboys in our equipment. And as we get a contact, we would communicate that to the TACO. He'd be basically like a coach that would really coordinate all of the rest of the sonoboys. And we would drop sonoboy pattern closer and closer and closer until we knew exactly where the submarine was. We did that through basic geometry or triangulation from bearings.
And they did this during World War II, too, with the sonoboys. And
they were developed at the end of World War II, and the equipment just kept getting better and better as the submarines got quieter and quieter.
Okay. Now, you've identified a hit, right? A blip hit? Mm-hmm. What did you call it?
Well, it was a contact.
Contact.
Target of interest. Diafire 31.
How did you know when it wasn't an American submarine? Obviously by the sound, but did you have a chart where the American submarines were to be, or were they kind of free-form, just go wherever they wanted to go?
That's kind of an interesting question. In the beginning, we never dealt with U.S. submarines. They were very secret. We never knew where they were. When we did encounter them, we would get debriefs saying, "No, you did not see that submarine there."
We were not there.
Yeah. And then as the Soviets became our friends, all of a sudden everybody was looking for other missions. And we work with U.S. nuclear submarines a lot. And I will tell you that finding a U.S. nuclear submarine is much more difficult than finding a Soviet submarine.
Because?
They're very quiet.
Because?
They've got just better sound equipment, sound deadening equipment. The propellers are much better. And all the basic noises that a submarine puts out, the U.S. submarines were just that much quieter.
Could you, and have you on occasion, heard conversation?
No, but I never heard conversations, at least on my equipment, we never did. But we did hear banging, clanging, valves, stuff like that.
Randy's got something he'd like to add.
Yeah, this is a story. When the Russians first deployed into the Gulf of Mexico with their submarines, that was a big event. And we had just come back from Vietnam. We were in a stand down. They reactivated us. They made us move on the base and put us on 30-minute alert. And we were down there in the Mediterranean. And the Gulf, and we were dropping sonoboys to try to find Soviet submarines in the Gulf of Mexico. And what had happened to one of the flights before us is they dropped these sonoboys in the water, and the Russian submarine was on the surface. So the Russian picked it up, and the saltwater battery was still working, and it was broadcasting all this Russian talk on the sonoboy as it went into the ship. And then suddenly there was some screaming and yelling, and the noise stopped. Well, we took this back to the wing, and the Russian guy analyzed it, and the talk was, "Get rid of that blankety blank American sonoboy. We've got so many of these on the ship now. All they do is take up room and throw that overboard again."
Okay, they had probably made ashtrays out of some of them. And
They said that every Soviet submarine had a complete set of American sonoboys on it because we'd thrown so many out, and they'd pick them up for intelligence purposes to see if we had new ones. And so this Russian talk came across, the thing was recorded, and we all got excited about what it was, but it was really nothing.
Jerry.
Yes.
Okay, you made contact. You made contact with an unidentified. It's not an American. Who do you alert?
Well, my communication, first of all, I would have to determine what the contact was. And you do that by knowing the acoustic signature of each submarine in the world. And every one was different, just like your fingerprints are different. So it would basically be up to the acoustic operators to decide, was that the target of interest or not? Once I determined it was a target of interest, I would communicate that to the tactical coordinator, who would then develop additional tactics to localize and get closer to the submarine.
And
drop more sonoboys. And that's why we had a lot of them on the airplane.
Did you ever have to scramble jets or boats to... were they getting too close to the United States territorial waters?
What happened, in fact, the first time I ever found a submarine, I guess you always remember your first episode in anything, we flew into Bermuda, And off of Bermuda, there used to be a thing called Yankee Station, where the Soviet Yankee ballistic missile submarines had a track that were right off our coast.
Was that by the Bermuda Triangle?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Just south of Bermuda.
Okay. All right.
And
so here you are in the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, we landed in Bermuda. We were working up our quals. And basically, the regular Navy that were there had three broke airplanes. And then when we landed, they said, "Hey, am I glad to see you guys." Next thing I know, instead of doing a SURVOPS surveillance mission, we were tasked to go find the Yankee because they lost track of it. We put in a barrier. We monitored it for about an hour. We moved the barrier, and our ordnance men start cooking. I can still remember eating a pork chop, and when I first saw the first glimmer of a Soviet submarine. And we actually gained contact. We tracked him for 6 hours. And if you ever seen the excitement of a guy when he catches a bass, you ought to see 14 guys in an airplane catch a submarine.
Sure.
Very, very exciting.
Sure.
I still remember that.
And then what? Okay, you're tracking it. You've made the contact. You've made the identification.
And we just kept tracking it, basically because of the...
Until it gets out of your grid.
Yeah. Well, actually what happened, we turned it over to another airplane. We would put in turnover sonobuoys, and they would monitor sonobuoys. We tracked submarines all the way from Keflavik down into Azores, down into the Gibraltar Straits, into Sigonella, Sicily. The same submarine would be tracked 24 hours a day.
Would you track a submarine just about on every mission?
No, we had a series of missions. We did a lot of SURVOPS. In other words, we went looking for specific surface shipping. We would mostly Soviets back then. We would actually go after intelligence ships, the AGIs. They were around. We had to monitor those, and all that information was basically documented, and it went into the intelligence network that became part of the huge computer in the sky for all of Pentagon.
Randy, one of the things we talked about on the way up here was that you carried torpedoes. Now, tell us a little bit. Oh, we do have that. Well, I'll tell you what. Let me wait for that, because we're coming up on a break anyway. So why don't we go to a break, and we can come back with the ordnance man, Mr. Bob Hudson, who has been... Oh, there we go. By the way, we're right on the flight line here at Selfridge, and my engineer tells me to keep talking through it. So, but anyway, we're getting up to a break. This is Bob Gould right here in Veterans Radio. We're live from Selfridge Air and National Guard. There we go, Air National Guard Base right here in Mount Clemens, Michigan, on the Ave Maria Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Private Dale Hansen killed 12 Japanese soldiers in a one-man attack on their positions. Details after this.
There's always a moment of truth where I say, look, it's either put up or shut up. I had crossed that thin line. We were yelling our hearts out. Even in our weakness, even in our pain, we continued to push. I told myself, you can suck up the pain for another mile and a half, and you will be a Marine. I don't know where I got the energy from. I don't know where the pain went to. But all I know is that I had what it took. I am a United States Marine.
AFC Darrell Willis proved he could be one of us. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES.
Hansen unhesitatingly took the initiative during a critical stage of the action and, armed with a rocket launcher, crawled to an exposed position where he attacked and destroyed a strategically located hostile pillbox. With his weapon subsequently destroyed by enemy fire, he seized a rifle and continued his one-man assault. Reaching the crest of a ridge, he opened fire on 6 Japanese and killed 4 before his rifle jammed. Attacked by the 2 remaining Japanese, he beat them off with the butt of his rifle and then climbed back to cover. Returning with another weapon and supply of grenades, he fearlessly advanced and destroyed a strong mortar position and annihilated 8 more of the enemy.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Len Pitlack, CPA, is an award-winning consultant for the U.S. Small Business Development Center. Let him use his 25 years' experience to bring you, as an individual or small business owner, his professional and courteous tax and accounting services. Give Len Pitlack a call today at 734-993-1313.
Schrader Yacht Sales, the East Coast's finest dealer of Chris Craft, Island Packet Yachts, Packet Craft, Parker Fishing Boats, and Nautic Star Boats. Schrader Yachts is located at the top of Barnegat Bay in Point Pleasant, New Jersey. Our good friend Ray Schrader provides you, the customer, with over 30 years' experience in boat sales, sail, and power boats, both new and used. Schrader Yacht Sales offers a full-service storage facility and a reliable crew responsible for all of your boating needs. Specialists in electronics, they can accommodate your needs for radar, autopilot, air conditioning, GPS, heat, and communications. Give Ray a call at 732-899-8010. That's 732-899-8010, or go to SchraderYachts.com. That's SchraderYachts.com. Oh, by the way, tell Ray you heard about him on Veterans Radio, and he will personally deliver your new boat from Schrader Yachts anywhere there's water. Schrader Yachts, ready to serve all of your boating needs.
Okay, we're back here on Veterans Radio, and we're live here at Mount Clemens, the Selfridge Air National Guard Base. And I'm speaking with members of the Patrol Squadron 93 Association, guys that went out there, and they were the sub-hunters. And right now we're going back to Randy Hotmatten. If somebody wanted to come out here and see this airplane, what would they do?
Well, this is really a unique experience. This is the only P-3 Orion that we know of that's open for tours on the inside. And it's manned by the veterans who flew this airplane, maintained this airplane, and supported this airplane during its life. It's open every weekend out here at Selfridge Air National Guard Base, Saturday and Sunday, from 12 to 16:30, which is 4:30 p.m. for civilians. And it's a beautiful day to come out here and take a look at the airplane.
Oh, that's a perfect day. Okay, right. And when do you boys give tours? When is that again?
Well, again, noon to 4:30 p.m. every weekend, Saturday and Sunday.
Oh, okay. So you have some. How many members in the 93 Patrol Squadron?
We have a mailing list of about 300, and there's probably 100 of us that are active coming up here.
Yeah, locally here. And on your left, once again, here he is, Bob Hudson, who was out here giving us a hand earlier. Bob, why don't you get a little closer to the microphone? Bob, you were the ordnance man. And one of the things that Randy talked to me about was torpedoes. So not only could you track them, find them and track them, if you had to, you might even be able to sink them. Is that true?
That's true. We carried up to 8 in the bomb bay. Yeah, we could carry
all the time with every mission. You had torpedoes?
Not every mission.
Okay.
No. We would carry on occasion maybe 2 to 4 in the bomb bay.
I got to ask this. Did you have nuclear torpedoes?
No.
Oh, no. are you saying that because of security or?
No, I'm being honest. That's true.
Okay. Oh, so you did not?
No.
But they did have them in the arsenal?
Yes.
What in the world would you ever use a nuclear submarine or a nuclear torpedo for?
Maybe Randy could elaborate on that.
Go ahead.
Okay, we carried a variety of weapons for various things we did. We carried conventional depth charges. We carried nuclear depth charges. We carried homing torpedoes. We carried air-to-ground missiles in the form of the bullpup early on. Later on, we had the Harpoon missiles on this airplane. We rarely carried live ordnance on the airplane except for exercises. The only time I carried live ordnance on normal missions was when we were flying around Vietnam. We had the AGM-9s on the airplane.
What if you were attacked by another plane?
Well, we normally, this airplane only operated where we were given permission to by our opposing forces. We normally were 1,000 miles from land. Nobody could come out there and get us. If somebody put fighters and said they didn't want us to go there, we wouldn't go there. This airplane had no defensive capability against air attack.
Okay, but you could launch a torpedo.
We could launch torpedoes, depth charges, missiles. We had a variety of weapons we could use to complete the mission of this airplane.
Have you ever deployed any depth charges, Bob?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Did you do them in practice?
Yes, we did.
And how many of those did you carry on board?
We carried 3 of the depth charges in the
bomb
bay.
How many?
3.
3.
Yeah.
So you had depth charges and missiles and torpedoes and sonobuoys
and forward firing rockets.
And how many crew?
11 to 13 guys.
11 guys.
Yeah.
And you were, of course, one of them. What did you do during the 16-hour missions?
A little sleeping in the back until I was called upon.
Okay.
And
okay.
Then you'd come alive and load the sensors in and have them ready for the tackle.
Play cards and
yeah, and
whatever.
Cook.
Think
and
about
cook.
Home.
Jerry Locke enjoyed the cooking.
And it was probably a lot like firemen, right? Because when the alarm went off, you went off.
Right.
And get yourself going. What else can you add about ordnance that we need to know? Anything at all on that, no?
Not much more than Randy put out there. The main thing I did was get the sonar buoys programmed and ready for dropping. When the tackle would get hold of me, he'd let me know what he wanted.
Randy.
Bob is being modest in that case. The sonar buoy management was almost a nightmare. We had 32 channels. We used 31 of the channels, and we had to be very careful. If we put a bunch of 8-hour buoys in the water, they would lock up those channels that couldn't be used. So Bob had to say we couldn't just throw a sonar buoy in there. We had to get the exact sonar buoy with the exact channel and all of the things that went in there. So the management of sonar buoys between the sensor operator, the tackle coordinator, and the ordnanceman was a real key to making this mission work. And Bob was being modest on managing sonar buoys. It was like pulling teeth.
Randy, when you say you were responsible for safety of the aircraft, that was some of your responsibility, too, including maintaining the ordnance. It doesn't rattling around and bouncing off the sides and whatever.
Right. Well, if we were going to employ ordnance, there was a checklist we had to go through. We had to have our speed, altitude, under control, how much climbing, descending we're doing, how close we were to the water. There was explicit envelopes we had to go in for each weapon we were going to use.
Bob? Okay. What else you got I'm noticing something very basic behind you there. Is that part of the ordnance equipment? No, right up there. Yeah. What is...
That's a safety rail that we use.
No, I'm looking above that.
Oh. No, that's...
I mean, you have that. You have that here in the aircraft. What did you use that for? I mean, besides use it for the head, but...
Bob has picked out something that looks a lot like a toilet plunger.
Oh, yes.
And it's used for checking the venting on the fuel system when we're fueling the plane.
Give me that again.
It comes up under the wing. You reach up under the wing at the fuel where it vents.
Folks, we're looking at, I'm sure it's got a catalog number somewhere in the military for the Navy. Hmm?
Well, that's
an S4896-J. Somebody had to get it. Is a regular, well, it's got a toilet plunger head, but a different kind of handle, and used it for.
It's a hollow tube, and the toilet plunger head actually seals around the vent on the wing.
Okay.
And you put your hand at the bottom when they're fueling to make sure you've got venting going on. If you don't, you may blow a wing tank.
Okay, Bob Hudson, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. Randy, you got something to add?
Yeah, the fueling of the airplane was a critical thing. That this airplane would be on alert, we'd have about 30,000 pounds of fuel on it. And you had about a 30 to 45-minute window to launch. You had to fuel the airplane. So they could tuck up two trucks to it, and we could load about 6,000 gallons of fuel in 15 minutes. If the vents in the tanks didn't work, it would blow the wing off the airplane. So while the fuel was going in, they had to run around and make sure the air was coming out of the tanks as the fuel went in there. And that was one of the jobs of the crew, normally accomplished by the flight engineer. And fuel management on this airplane was really one of the big parts of this mission. I remember I did a mission out of Sigonella in the winter of 71, January, February. It was one of these routine surface surveillance. Just track this Soviet aircraft carrier while the destroyer who's supposed to track it goes in and gets some gas. And then the lines at the NATO base in Italy didn't match the American lines. They couldn't fuel the thing. And they said, can you guys stay up there a little longer? It wasn't supposed to be a 12-hour mission. It was a 16.7-hour mission. And we finally came back in because we only had about 6,000 pounds of fuel left. But during that flight, the flight engineer really has a job of managing that fuel, knowing where it is on the airplane, keeping it running to the engines, and to stay out there that long, we actually shut our engines off in flight to save gas. And the key guy to make that happen is our flight engineer.
Well, we'll get to Charlie in just a moment. Right now, we're going to take another quick break. You're listening to Veterans Radio live right here from Selfridge Air National Guard Base in Mount Clemens, Michigan. We'll be right back.
Gary Lilly & Associates is now Sperry Van Ness Lilly & Associates, the newest Michigan affiliate of a leader in the commercial real estate industry, Sperry Van Ness. More than 800 Sperry Van Ness advisors in 136 markets sold nearly $11 billion in commercial real estate last year. That was done by putting the client's interest first.
thereby generating maximum return for every property. When we list a property, we immediately place it on 6 internet commercial listing services and email it to 40,000 prospective buyers and 60,000 commercial brokers. We offer to split the commission 50-50. That means your interests, not ours, are placed first. To learn more, call Sperry Van S. Lillian Associates Commercial Realtors at 800-345-6694. That's 800-345-6694. Be advised, there is a difference.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University by combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call Aaron Flaherty, Assistant Director of Admissions, at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Okay, this is Bob Gould. We're back live from the Selfridge Air National Guard Base. I'm getting that better each time I say that, right? There we go. And we're recording for the first time inside a P3 Orion. Okay, there we are. And with me today is one of the other members of the Patrol Squadron 93 Association, Charlie Doran. Charlie Doran with the P3. I got that right. Yeah, the P3 was a flight engineer. Tell us a little bit about being a flight engineer.
Well, the flight engineer's job was quite complicated because with the Air Force, we were our own loadmaster, our own plane captain, our own flight engineer. So there was about 3 or 4 different jobs that were all encompassed in with the title of being flight engineer. And our duties would start out with the pre-flight of the aircraft, reading the logbook, making sure the discrepancies were repaired and, that the airplane was safely flyable. And we'd come out, do our walk-around inspection, fuel the aircraft for the mission, figure out how much gas.
What was your rank when you did this?
I was a first-class metalsmith.
E6. Oh, okay. So you were enlisted. With all that responsibility. Wow. I'm impressed.
Yeah, the officers were the pilots, the TACOs, and the navigators, and the rest of the crew was all enlisted. The radio operator, the radar, sonar, ordnanceman. So it was quite a mix, shall we say. And the crews were very tight. I mean, that's one of the things that I really found that I miss about it is the fact that the crew camaraderie, the friendships that you made.
Oh, you were together for 16-hour missions. You had to get along, right? And if you didn't, what did you do? Or what could you? I guess probably nothing.
Not much, because the only way out was right there.
Right there. And by the way, I'm looking outside the aircraft through the back door. But now, one of your other duties was as the head chef.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say head chef, but the off-duty engineer, the off-duty ordnanceman, would do the cooking, shall we say.
And what would you cook?
Oh, one-pot meals.
Uh-huh.
One of my specialties was raw fries, potatoes.
Raw fries. R-A-W, right? Raw fries. Okay, and what was that?
Take a potato and slice it up, throw it in
You folks all got a pen and paper out there, right? And you can go to our website afterwards and get this recipe. Go ahead. This is cut up the potatoes.
Right, and mix a little olive oil in, throw in some garlic, peppers, onions. Then when they were just about done, throw in about a dozen eggs.
A dozen eggs. You didn't have a microwave. What did you cook them on?
Oh, we brought skillets, electrical skillets. We did have an oven in the back where we could do frozen meals, unprepareds. We could get box lunches, but
and of course you must have had a refrigerator or something.
Oh, naturally.
Okay.
There's a small refrigerator in the back that we could keep our milk and eggs and stuff fresh.
Now, when you did cook, that would permeate the plane.
Oh, especially when you put the garlic in.
I'm going to say, okay, guys, how was it? Was it tolerable? Yeah, everybody's kind of shaking their hand, right? So there's a good and a bad to that, right?
Oh, it would permeate. Let me tell you.
And you really can't open the window here.
Not really.
No. So you kind of had what you had in the smell department, and that was that.
Yeah, but the drools would be high.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so then you feed everybody. Who did the dishes?
Mm-hmm. You just carried them back and did them.
When you landed?
Yeah, back when we landed, because okay. We didn't have a sink or running water or anything in there.
Right. Now, as the flight engineer, I'm looking here, too, though, at a couple of bunks. Was that the only bunks you had, those two right there that were in the back of the plane?
Well, it was kind of an unwritten rule. The off-duty engineer and the off-duty pilot were the ones that would have bunk duties. Everybody else, if they weren't busy during the mission, why, they'd find a place on the floor and just curl up and stack some Z's.
Randy's got something to add.
Now, one of the beauties of this airplane is that the floor is heated. Because of the metal in your shoes and stuff, if you didn't heat the floor, your feet would freeze to death up there at 20,000 feet. So they have like electric blankets for the floor. So if you were kind of cool, you just kind of lay down on the floor under the tack station, and it was like a warm, cozy bed. I preferred that to the bunk beds where it was kind of cold in the back. I'd like to lay down under the tack station.
And sleep.
And take a little nap.
I mean, I'm looking here, and okay, all right. Yeah, you had some room. Uh-huh.
Our day ran. Like, that mission that was 16.7 hours was a 24-hour duty day for us. By the time you got out of bed, took a three-hour briefing, got on station, came back, did a two-hour post-briefing. We put in some horrendous long days to pull off these missions.
Okay, Charles, back to you, being the flight engineer. The flight engineer, what else did you do with the engines? Did you monitor the RPMs?
Were you listening to them? You would be amazed how much a seat of the pants. Myself personally, I could feel a problem before I could hear it or see it.
Feel it?
Oh, yeah. The aircraft had a vibration line.
So it had a signature.
Right.
And I'm getting a yes here from my sonar man. Okay. Uh-huh.
And depending on how much you like the crew members or dislike them, you could take and move that vibration line. And if you put it right under his seat, it wouldn't take too long, and he'd start talking.
Because why? I mean, it would be so...
Well, it's kind of complicated, but one of the problems with the four engines is to get them synchronized so that they're turning at the same speed. And we had a little electronic box that we could set up the RPM so that they were all turning the same speed. And if you increased or decreased the RPM a little bit, you could move that line in the aircraft.
Okay, okay, okay.
So we'd have some fun with it sometimes.
I'm speaking with Charlie Doran, the flight engineer. And anything else you want to add about flight engineering?
Well, the cockpit is a very busy place, and the engineer's responsibility was to keep everything running. If a problem did crop up, to handle that emergency, or to bring on a backup system, or work your way around the particular system that you lost.
Randy?
Yeah, one of the things that we did in this airplane that may sound strange to a lot of people, we intentionally shut our engines off in flight to save gas. If we were down at low altitude, say doing a tactical plot in the Mediterranean, before they had satellites and surveillance airplanes, we did it the way they did in World War II. We got down on the water, we used our radar, and we'd like have to do a ship count in the Med. And this is where we'd shut down one of our engines, and then we'd fly along about probably 270 to 300 miles an hour and just look at these ships, take a photo of them, plot where they were. And that's where the role of the tactical navigator came in to keep track of where these ships are, because this is all important intelligence to keep the track of where the ships are, the amount of ships in the ocean, all part of the national big picture of what's going on in the world that this airplane did, besides tracking submarines, was track surface movement of the ship. And that's where the tactical navigator came in. He ran the plot that kept track of where everything was.
Oh, what a great segue. We'll be right back. This is Bob Gould from the Selfridge Air National Guard Base, right here inside a P-3 Orion Sub-Hunter. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University by combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call Aaron Flaherty, Assistant Director of Admissions, at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Okay, we're right back here from Selfridge, and I have with me, once again, Randy Houghton. Randy, you wanted to add something about the tours.
Just wanted to remind everybody, if you're interested in seeing the P-3 and visiting with the veterans you hear on the radio, this airplane is open for tours to the public every weekend from noon till 4:30 in the afternoon. That's Saturday and Sunday, and just come to the Selfridge gate on Hall Road. Tell them you want to come to the museum. They'll let you come in here, and you can meet us in person.
Do you need any kind of ID to get in the base?
All you need is a pictured government ID with your driver's license. That's all you need.
Okay. All right. Okay. Our last guest here as part of the 93 Patrol Squadron Association is Richard Zanetti. Richard was the tactical navigator. That sounds like you did it all, man. You made it all happen.
Well, not exactly all happening, but it's a paper drill. And I got to chime in on what Randy said. I think anybody that comes out for the tours, the people that flew in this aircraft will make it come alive, okay? So you'll have a chance.
Just like today,
what we're doing. And you've got a total walkthrough, and you usually have probably two people here. I also got to thank Charlie for, he was on my crew. We had about 11 crews here, okay? So anybody that could pick up a frying pan and do stuff with unprepared rations, because you had three options. You had box lunches, mystery meat that we always wanted, that we were getting, dinners.
And that was rainbow mystery meat.
Rainbow mystery meat.
Different colors
and
on it.
And we actually had a crew box that had all kinds of cooking equipment in it. So anybody that could come back there and actually do cooking duties, it was greatly appreciated. So, Charlie, a tip-o to you and anybody else that did the cooking duties. I didn't have the time to do it because as a tactical navigator, you've got a real paper drill. It's a pretty long mission.
And I do want to add something. There is plenty of room in this aircraft. Sometimes you get into an aircraft and you're going to go visit a museum, and it's real tight and stuffy and claustrophobic. This is not. This has got a lot of room, and these gentlemen are here to help you along and to give you all the information on the airplane. Getting back to being a tactical navigator. Okay, they were spotted. A contact was made. You're in the grid. Now what?
Well, you've got two different aspects of the tactical navigator job. One is to get you out to the operating area. A lot of paper. You got to track the aircraft systems.
There's no signpost in the ocean.
There's no signpost in the ocean. Nobody's telling you you can't go flying low and along a highway. So you're navigating the aircraft out there. Then you get to the op area. Now you're on station. Now you're working closely with the tactical coordinator. And you go and you get briefed, so you know pretty much what that mission is, and you're kind of an adjunct to the TACO. He's the mission commander. So once you're out there, now you are backing up with the TACO information that's coming in and the buoys that go on the scope, because what you're trying to do is solve what kind of a submarine you have and its course and speed.
GPS you did not have at that time.
No.
So how did you know where you were? Did you use the stars?
Yeah, you had a variety of things in your kind of your bag in order to find out where you're at. Initially, the earlier systems were an inertial navigation system that was upgraded, so you always had that. But any black box is going to go out on you, so you're down to dead reckoning information, maybe Loran long range type of a navigation system, and Celestial. And Celestial is actually an excellent tool to locate where you are. You put everything together just to make sure you know where the aircraft is. Once you're in the op area, what you're doing now is you're tracking the tactical plot.
Did you ever get lost?
No.
No. Okay.
Not this kid. But then I had some other navigation training before I came to the VP community. I'm an out-of-community guy. Okay, I was basically a VR navigator, which trained you basically in a lot of different types of navigation.
Well, anything else you'd like to add about being a tactical navigator here in the P3?
It's a paper drill. There's a lot of paper that's created because when you're done with a long mission, you're going to go back with the tactical, the TACO, and you're going to give them a lot of paper about what happened. Just like the sensor operators, there's a lot of paper generated from a mission on the debrief side.
Well, I want to thank all of you gentlemen for being here today and for helping us get this program going, especially to Randy Hatton. Randy, you got something that you'd like to say about the tour again? Why don't you give us a little bit more information on that?
Okay, the airplane again is open for the veterans of this squadron to demonstrate what this airplane did during the Cold War. And I tell the story here quickly. I was giving a tour one day, and I heard this lady in broken English after I told the story of flying against the Soviets. And she said, thank you, thank God every night that you never quit. The Russians very, very bad. They kill my friends. They take my country. The Czechs suffered under the Russians. But the Americans never gave up, and I am now free to come to this country. I thank you, I thank you, I thank you. And that's what it was all about.
What an appropriate way to end this segment of the show. That's right. And I'm looking here at five guys, big smiles on their faces. They are ready to welcome you to come to the Selfridge Air National Guard Base. By the way, if you come out 94, you get off at the 59, that's Hall Road, 59, US 59, no, M59 exit. Once again, this is Bob Gould, Veterans Radio. Ken, back to you.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Good job. And our thanks to our sponsors, the Marine Scholars Fund, Quantum Physical Therapy, Legal Help for Vets, Len Pitlack, CPA, Schrader Yachts, and Gary Lilly and Associates. And a special thanks to Patrol Squadron 93, Alumni Association, for hosting today's program. And next week, Seabees with Gary Lilly. And we say goodbye to Erwin Burns, our technical assistant. We'll miss you, Erwin. And until next week, you are dismissed.
Sink the army, sink the army, pray.